course. I know you and Angelica find him tedious. We do not. But he is just young. He doesn't know yet not to ramble. He is very earnest, that. Earnest and sweet. And you see, Eliza, do not think me a silly goose. But I have always been the one people took care of. First Mama babied me, then you and Angelica. Now I find men want to baby me, bolster me up with fine words and fine promises, and wear me on their arms like a gaudy bauble. Stephen does none of that. Rather, he looks to me, for strength, as if he can scarce believe that I should care for him. For the first time, I have found someone whose life I want to make better. It's like coming upon a bird with a broken wing and nurturing it back to full strength. Yes, that's it. Here's a fellow who needs me to take care of him. Dear sweet Peg, Eliza wanted to believe it too. I suppose when you have the opportunity to do something of value for someone you love, you have the responsibility to do it. If that is the case, then I am truly happy for you. But surely Papa will not approve, Peggy moaned into the pillow. He thinks Stephen is much too young and untested, and he would prefer a bold soldier like your Colonel Hamilton, who marches around with medals clinging against his breast. What do you mean, my Colonel Hamilton? Oh, dearest sister, for all of your intelligent ways, are you too pious to recognize a lovesick man when he stands before you, wearing his heart on his sleeve? Everyone seems to see it but you. He was mooning over you all evening. The bedroom door flew open, and moonlight streamed in behind a tall figure. Brr, what have I missed? Angelica lifted the covers and slipped in bed between them. Where have you been? Angelica smiled mysteriously. You know where. Eliza did not press. Peg is telling me what she really feels about Stephen. Is that so? And what do you feel?
I love him, Ange.
And you will do well to keep your claws away from him.
He is young and has a soft heart.
Truly, you love him.
With all my heart.
Angelica cackled.
A marvelous twist. The quietest man at the table wins the family beauty by coming up with nothing at all to say.
Peggy bopped her oldest sister over the head with her pillow. Goose feathers floated in the air.
He's a quiet man, not a fool.
I'm teasing, Peg. To tell the truth, he has rather grown on me, and no one can deny he is turning into a handsome young man. Which is more than I can say for my suitor.
Speaking of which, did you see church? What happened tonight?
Asked Peggy.
Oh, my goodness, Eliza said, laughing. This bed may be too fragile to withstand any more surprises.
How surprising could it possibly be that I have found a suitor with wits to match my own? Announced Angelica.
And a fortune that will sustain me in high society for as long as I may live?
Church has proposed at last, has he?
Said Eliza. Peggy turned toward her sister and said softly,
But do you love him?
Let's not over-egg the pudding, dear Peg.
Angelica tugged at a ribbon on her younger sister's nightcap.
Perhaps for me to love and be loved is an impossible quest. I simply know that in John Church I have met my match. And in one way or another, whether by elopement or a fine wedding, he will be my husband.
Angelica pulled up the covers and stared up at the dark ceiling.
I trust that Papa will be but temporarily dismayed.
The deal was as good as done.
Her sisters knew it, too.
That's all fine and well for you, Angelica, said Peggy. You have always gotten whatever it is you wanted by sheer force of will. But what of me and my Stephen?
Peggy sounded as though she might burst into tears at any moment.
Surely Papa will be swayed by the Van Rensselaer wealth and the long-held trust between our two families. But do you think he can be persuaded to allow the marriage?
My dear little Peg, said Angelica, you have always dragged along behind me, imitating me at every turn since you were a child. Be aware that I now have a plan and fully intend to carry it out. So here is my advice to you. Perhaps this is just one more time you dare not hesitate to follow your big sister's lead.
And what about Colonel Hamilton? Said Peggy.
What about him? Said Angelica.
He means to take our Eliza away, said Peggy.
Does he now? Said Angelica impishly. And what say you, dear sister? Shall you allow yourself to be swept off your feet? Eliza hid underneath the covers.
I have no idea what you both are going on about. You were both the ones with secret romances, not me. He has not even announced his courtship yet.
Maybe he is shy, said Peggy.
Angelica snorted. Of all the things he is, I don't think shy is quite the word.
Perhaps, said Eliza, muffled from under the blankets. We are just friends, and he does not fancy me at all.
Oh, Eliza, said Angelica, you really are dense sometimes.
He was very kind to me this evening, said Peggy loyally. Said I should tell you both how I feel about Stephen so you can stop your taunting.
I think you should accept him, Eliza, if he asks. You can do worse than to marry a kind man.
I think kindness, out of all the virtues, is the best quality to have.
He does have a good heart, said Eliza, popping up from the pillows. The men love him.
But he lacks a great fortune and has no name and no family, reminded Angelica.
Well, said Peggy, we have name and family, if not fortune, enough for him. Don't you think, Eliza?
For once, Eliza had to agree with her sweet younger sister rather than her smart older one.
20. First comes friendship. Continental Army Barracks, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. Lawrence and Lafayette remained in town for 3 more days, but the snows were still so bad that there was no possibility of sleigh rides to dancing assemblies or dinner parties. Work was busy, and Alex's time was split between taking meetings with General Washington and the rest of the top brass, and carousing with his comrades till all hours of the night. Several times, Alex attempted to pull rank as the aide-de-camp to the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, in order to be alone with his friend before he left. But General Washington was almost as fond of the son of Henry Lawrence, Washington's southern counterpart in the Continental Congress, as Alex was, and always invited him along to meetings and inspections. On the afternoon of the third day of Lauren's visit, a messenger arrived from Charleston. Reports had come in that General Clinton, the commander-in-chief of the British forces, was shifting the focus of the war to the south. After being driven from Philadelphia a year and a half ago, General Clinton had holed up in New York City. But since Ambassador Franklin and the Marquis de Lafayette had persuaded the French to enter the war on the side of the Americans, Clinton had come to the conclusion that the northern states, with their close proximity to French Canada, were increasingly vulnerable to a combined French-American attack, and he should shift their efforts south. The South was the engine of the American economy. Much of its food came from below the newly surveyed Mason-Dixon line, as well as 2 of its most valuable exports, tobacco and cotton. If Clinton could cut off the South from the North, the cash-strapped nation would soon run completely out of money. Even before the messenger had finished delivering his news, John Lawrence was shifting about in his seat. As soon as General Washington dismissed them, he raced out of the building, It was all Alex could do to keep up with him. "Lawrence!" he called after his friend, fleeing out of headquarters without even bothering to put on his coat amid the winter chill. "Lawrence, wait!"
At the sound of Alex's voice, Lawrence halted, panting wildly. He waited until his friend caught up to him.
"I have to go," he said. "Charleston is my home. My family is there. My mother and brothers and sisters, and Mepkin. Your beloved estate. You talk about it as though it were your child. More like my parent. I would not be the man I am were it not for what I learned at Mepkin. One day when you establish an estate of your own, you will feel the same way about it. I must return home to protect her."
"Of course," Alex said, even though he had no real experience with what having a home meant.
"I wouldn't dream of trying to persuade you otherwise." "Then give us a good hug farewell, Alex."
The two men embraced there on the path to the Ford mansion. When Alex stepped back, though, Lawrence held on to one of his hands.
"And take the advice of your fondest friend. The Schuyler girl is yours for the asking. It's time to rally, soldier. Do not wait to speak your heart."
Alex was surprised to see tears in his friend's eyes, and he felt an upswell of emotion in his own chest. He knew Lawrence was right, and that he was perilously close to losing his chance.
"Be safe, my friend, and send me a lock of hair from General Clinton's head when you drive him from Carolina,"
said Alex at last. Lawrence bowed with mock formality, then turned and strode off toward his quarters. His shoulders were square, his back straight and proud, yet Alex couldn't shake the idea that his dear friend was marching off to his doom. The next morning was taken up with routine administrative duties, although routine was hardly the right word. The weather of winter of 1779 to 80 could hardly be compared with that of 1777 to 78, which the Continental Army had spent freezing at Valley Forge. During that terrible season, one in four American soldiers died. Diseases and injuries, which would normally have been no more than inconveniences, were made rapacious by poor shelter and few provisions. The current season was milder, but the war had been going on for two additional years, and supplies were meager. Storeroom ledgers were alarming. Reports from the infirmaries were dispiriting. Among Alex's most dreaded tasks was writing the letter to the family of a fallen soldier, informing them that their son had died, not in battle like an Asgardian warrior, but in a cot of a fever because he could not get warm enough or fill his belly with enough sustenance to fight off the ravages of injury and infection.
"My dear Mr. and Mrs. Willie, it is with great sadness for your loss, but also great respect for your son's commitment to the cause of freedom, that I write to inform you of the passing of Josiah on the 19th day of February in the year of our Lord, 1780.
Alex had penned no fewer than 16 such letters that morning, and on no fewer than 7 different occasions he had to abandon his draft and begin again, because he'd mistakenly used the name John for whatever fallen soldier he was meant to be commemorating. When the letters were complete, he told Corporal Weston that he was off to run an errand. He grabbed his coat and hurried from headquarters. He had no fixed plans when he left. He only knew he needed to get away from his dismal task and worries about his friend, who was riding south toward the fiercest troops the British had mustered. But his feet knew where to take him. Within 10 minutes of leaving the Ford mansion, he found himself back again at his post on Chapel Street, standing before the 2-story white house. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon when Alex banged the knocker on the Cochrane's front door. He had no idea whether anyone would be home or not,
especially since Eliza's sisters had arrived in Morristown. No doubt she was off somewhere doing the Lord's work with them. But he thought about what Lawrence had said.
I'm a soldier. It's time to rally.
But maybe he should just go and get back to his...
The door pulled open, and Ulysses greeted him.
Colonel Hamilton, he nodded, motioning that he should enter.
Alex thanked the old butler and walked into the hall, which in truth was not much warmer than it was outside.
Ulysses beckoned him to follow him into a parlor, which was considerably warmer. A fire blazed in the hearth, and the scent of spiced cider oozed from a brass kettle hanging over it. Alex's soldier-trained eyes peered into the shadowed room. Its windows faced northeast, but did not spy an occupant.
Miss Schuyler, Colonel Hamilton is calling.
A shadow detached itself from the recesses of a high-backed wing chair, and Eliza's face, turning toward the door, greeted his.
Colonel Hamilton!
Eliza jumped to her feet, sending an embroidering ring and several spools of thread and a pair of long needles flying.
No, no, not to worry,
she said as Ulysses stooped forward to pick up the fallen objects.
I'll get it. Please bring Mr. Hamilton a cup. I'm sure he would enjoy a glass of hot cider. It is particularly frosty today.
She knelt down as the butler retreated from the room, her nimble fingers retrieving the scattered articles.
Indigo, indigo, I am sure I was working with... Oh!
She started as she looked up and found Alex kneeling beside her, his gloved hands proffering the spool of blue thread. He pressed it into her hand more firmly than he needed to.
Here you are, Miss Schuyler.
I... Thank you, Colonel.
He helped her stand, taking her hand once more. He didn't seem to want to release it.
Somehow I take it you are not here to invite me to a sleigh ride, she said with a hint of smile.
Alex shook his head as the door opened behind them, and a maid entered with a pewter cup. He crossed to a chair and waited till Eliza had taken a seat before he, too, sat down. Louisa brought them each a tall drink of cider, poked the fire, then asked if there was anything else needed.
No, thank you, Louisa. You may go.
She waited until the maid was gone before speaking again.
I am sorry to say that my aunt and uncle are not at home. Dr. Cochran is attending to the troops, and my aunt is, as always, acting as nurse and assistant, and my sisters are out at the moment.
Alex spoke frankly.
I did not come to see them.
Then, fearing he was insinuating too much, he said,
Colonel Lawrence left yesterday evening. I thought you would like to know.
Oh, that is too bad. I know you are dear friends. Did he take the Marquis with him?
No. General Lafayette remains among us, though he will be off soon. There are rumors of British activity in coastal Connecticut, and he is going to investigate.
Ah, so you will be left quite friendless and bereft.
Not entirely bereft, I hope,
Alex said, staring directly into Eliza's eyes. But his gaze must have been too intense, for she turned away suddenly and reached for her embroidery. He saw now that it wasn't a ring for a pillow sham, but rather the sleeve of a uniform she was working on. She was sewing on an insignia of rank.
You give so much to our troops, Alex said now. If there were decorations for non-combatants, you would be the first to receive one.
I fear I do not do nearly enough, Eliza said. Especially since coming here, to a strange town where I have not the network of friends and acquaintances to tap for resources for our boys.
Alex knew that he should tell her that what she did was more than adequate. But something held his tongue. At length he spoke.
You will forgive me, Miss Schuyler. I am afraid I do not know why I came here this afternoon. but I could not help but want to see you. I think I wanted consolation.
Colonel Hamilton, have you lost someone dear to you?
Alex thought of Lauren's walking away, and the number of times he had written his name in the place of one or another fallen soldier. I hope not, he said.
Colonel Hamilton,
Eliza said again, concern etched all over her gentle face. It was a face he could imagine waking up to every morning, and in his dreams she was always there.
I beg your pardon, Miss Schuyler, Alex said.
He broke off. Then a thought came to him, unbidden.
Have you ever been to the infirmaries?
Eliza knew what he meant.
You mean the wards, where the soldiers recuperate?
I'm afraid I have only been to the examining rooms when I helped my aunt administer the inoculation for the pox.
It is a difficult thing to recover in the coldness and anonymity of a hospital, as opposed to the comfort and familiarity of one's home. There are no books, no mother or servants, no little brothers and sisters to distract one from the boredom or the pain. I think that our soldiers would appreciate it very much if they had a visitor every now and then.
Eliza looked taken aback at first, and then chagrined.
Of course. And here I am, sewing on silly little epaulettes that turn an ensign into a lieutenant and a lieutenant into a major. Did I get that right?
As the daughter of a general, Eliza knew the insignia well, but she felt the need to be a little self-deprecating. She continued,
I shall make arrangements with my uncle to visit them as soon as possible.
Yes, Alex said. That is, I was thinking, perhaps I could take you there now.
Oh,
Eliza said. Then,
oh, again. Of course. Just let me put on something warm.
She stood up, and only then did Alex notice that she was wearing a simple woolen dress. Warm, if one were inside, near a fire, but hardly suited to the freezing weather.
He stood up, too. I'm sorry, I'm being stupid, he said. I should have written and given you advance notice. We can do this another day. Tomorrow I have to drill. Friday, then...
Nonsense, Eliza said. If the truth be known, I am half crazy with boredom. Peggy has been spending all her time with Stephen, and Angelica is off who knows where. While Aunt Gertrude and Uncle John are off saving lives, I am left here for 6 or 8 or 10 hours at a time sewing epaulettes on sleeves. Please, I beg of you, put me to real use.
Alex waited while she slipped from the room. She was back some 15 minutes later. It was unclear to him whether she'd changed her dress or not, but now she was bundled beneath several layers of coat and shawl and hat and gloves. He did see that she had replaced her silk slippers for a pair of sturdy leather boots with a pointed toe and tiny heel.
I am ready for the fiercest storm, she said. Please, lead on.
It was only when they were outside that Alex realized he should have commandeered a buggy for this trip. The nearest infirmary was half a mile away, and though Eliza was dressed for the weather, he had only his greatcoat and tricorn. From chest to knees he was snug, but his exposed neck and poorly shod feet immediately felt the nip of the cold. Yet when Eliza crooked her elbow to accept his, all thoughts of the cold vanished from his mind, and he set off toward the infirmary at a leisurely pace, half hoping the journey would never end. As they strolled, he told Eliza of his gloom at Lawrence's departure, and the strange vision he kept having of his friend's death as he wrote out letters of consolation to the families of fallen soldiers. He kept telling himself to change the subject. Talk of death and war were not the things to win a girl's heart. But the words came of their own accord. Though Eliza said very little as he spoke, her step never faltered, and her arm in his never shook. More than once, he felt her reach across with her free hand to pat his.
Was he mad, wooing a girl by taking her to the infirmary? What was he thinking? But Eliza Schuyler did not seem to mind.
Romance during wartime, he thought. In exceptional times, none of the usual rules apply. Then again, perhaps it's not the times that are exceptional, he thought. Perhaps it's the girl.
21. Soldiers and Suitors. See Infirmary, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. The C Infirmary was housed in a long stone barn. The structure had been crudely winterized during its conversion, and the roof had been lowered to keep the heat from disappearing into the rafters. But even so, the barn had not been designed for human habitation, and the four cast-iron stoves deployed along its length barely raised the temperature above freezing. 10 cots stretched up each side of the long space, 20 in all, and puffs of breath could be seen floating in front of pale faces. Eliza shook her head at the sight and pulled a small notebook and pencil from her reticule and scrawled a note.
"What are you writing?" the colonel asked, intrigued.
For a moment, she was consciously aware of his presence and felt the quickening beat of her heart, but she took hold of herself and her emotions in order to concentrate on the task at hand. "Lists! We need more stoves," she told him. "More stoves and blankets." She waved a hand at the vast space. "This simply will not do."
"If anyone can find them, I have no doubt it's you."
An orderly dozing near one of the stoves snapped to attention as they approached.
"Good afternoon, Colonel Hamilton," he barked, saluting.
His face was flushed from the heat so close to the stove, his collar undone, revealing a slightly moist neck.
"Corporal Weston!"
exclaimed Eliza, delighted to recognize a familiar face.
"You know this man?" Colonel Hamilton demanded, sounding just a bit jealous.
Eliza turned to him, smiling.
"Of course. I inoculated him from the pox." "What on earth are you doing here, Corporal?"
Weston looked sheepish. "I got a bit ill from the inoculation."
"I'm sorry to hear that. It should pass sooner rather than later. But I have to ask, Corporal Weston, why is your chair pushed so close to the stove? It seems to be rather uncomfortable for you, if the floridity of your cheeks is any measure."
Weston's eyes widened in surprise.
"Why, it's the warmest spot in the room, miss. In case you haven't noticed, it's winter."
"Indeed, I have noticed. As have, I suspect, the 20 men who lie on these cots, much farther from the stove than you are."
19, miss," Corporal Weston said defensively. "One of the beds emptied earlier this morning."
"Emptied?" Eliza repeated. "You mean its occupant died?"
Her voice was all but an accusation.
"Yes, miss," Corporal Weston answered weakly. "There are 3 more stoves, miss."
"And 19 more patients. Might I suggest that you move one or two of the cots closer to this stove and find a place to sit that will be less uncomfortably hot? I do so hate to see one of our brave soldiers suffering."
"It takes at least 2 men to move a bed, miss. I'm the only attendant on duty."
"I'm sure Colonel Hamilton would be happy to assist."
She turned to him for the first time since they'd entered the infirmary, brave enough to meet his piercing gaze, which never seemed to leave her face. Why on earth was he looking at her like that? Was that what Peggy and Angelica meant when they said he mooned over her all during dinner? And if so, did he notice that she looked at him that way as well?
"Colonel?"
As if roused from a reverie, he snapped to attention.
"Corporal, grab the foot end and be quick about it," he said, trotting toward the nearest bed.
Its young occupant appeared unconscious. A downy peach fuzz sprouted along the edge of his jaw. Eliza watched as Alex tucked the soldier's blanket around his shoulders and tenderly patted his hand.
Get some rest, boy. You will need it for the long journey ahead.
Eliza pulled gently away from Alex's side and approached the fellow in the next bed. Another pale young face peered up at her curiously, having obviously heard the commotion when she came in. Eliza introduced herself, and the soldier said his name was Private Wallace. He was perhaps 20, but his hand in hers was as weak as a boy half his age.
"How are you today, Private Wallace? Is there anything I can get you?"
"Just the sight of a female face is enough to brighten up the day,"
Private Wallace answered.
"Have you no other visitors?"
"None besides the doctors, and they're so busy they only come once a day, usually."
"No family? That's terrible."
Private Wallace just shrugged.
"We hail from all across the North, and some even as far south as Virginia. The males being what they are these days, most of our families don't hear that we've been injured until we've been discharged or, you know, discharged."
His eyes floated up toward the heavens, but Eliza's fell to the bed, where she couldn't help but notice the flat spot beneath the blanket below Private Wallace's left knee where his ankle and foot should have been.
"I'm one of the lucky ones," Wallace said, seeing where she was looking. "Bullet hit below the knee, so I still have the joint left, and the doc says I'm past the risk of infection. I just have to get my strength up, and then I'll be making my way home to Massachusetts. I've been practicing my letters," he said, indicating a small volume that sat, in lieu of a table, on the floor beside his cot. "I thought I might apprentice myself to a printer when I go home. If it was good enough work for Ambassador Franklin, I figure it's probably good enough for me, too."
Eliza passed a few more words with him before moving on to the next bed. The stories were much the same, at least where the patients were awake. The room was cold and the food was poor, but what they claimed really bothered them was the boredom. Out of the 14 to 16 hours they were awake each day, they had human companionship for perhaps 20 or 30 minutes. Eliza decided that she should visit the ward every day. She would commission Peggy and Angelica to visit some of the other infirmaries in the camp. If she couldn't gather supplies or money as she had done in Albany, and if she had not the medical skills her aunt possessed, she could at least read a story to a convalescing soldier, or listen to his stories about his home hundreds or thousands of miles away. Darkness had fallen by the time she and the colonel had finished the rounds. Eliza turned to him.
"I must thank you for bringing me here, Colonel Hamilton. I believe I can procure some more blankets for this ward, and even one or two more stoves. My aunt tells me that there are many empty houses in town."
"It's I who should thank you," Alex answered. "I really had no intention of bringing you here today. Any other girl would have run away."
"I'd like to think I'm not like any other girl," Eliza answered. She hadn't meant her answer to sound flirtatious. 2 hours in an infirmary can take that right out of you. But the words came before she could stop them.
"I like to think that as well," Alex answered,
and to her surprise, he laughed.
"I swear, if ever there was a more ungainly swain than myself, I have not heard of him."
"A swain, are you? Are you courting me, Colonel Hamilton?"
she asked with a shy smile.
"If you can call courting taking a girl to an infirmary as an afternoon's outing, and this, after only recently getting her to talk to him."
"That seems like ages ago now. I can't even remember what I found so objectionable about you," she said bluntly.
He grinned. "Well, I shall not remind you, then. Although, I find it to be a fine twist that you ended up joining me in a barn, after all."
She almost gasped, but her smile betrayed her amusement. and they were back at her aunt's house sooner than she would have liked. She turned to him at the door.
"I do not know that I should describe this afternoon as pleasant," she said. "Nevertheless, I must admit that I did enjoy my time with you, Colonel Hamilton."
"May I take that as permission to call again?"
"Somehow, I don't think you would stay away, even if I asked you to," she said, feeling quite as bold as Angelica all of a sudden.
"Oh, but I would. I would stay away, and ache for want of seeing you."
Eliza had to laugh. She knew she should scold him for pressing his suit so insistently, but the visit to the ward had reminded her that these were not normal circumstances under which to entertain suitors. It was a war, and war laid bare the urgency of things. What might have taken months under different circumstances was now unfolding over the course of days. "I expect to be busy during the afternoons seeing to the ward, but my evenings are likely to be free. If you wish to come by, I know my aunt and uncle always welcome your visits."
"But will you?" The laugh lines at the corners of his eyes tightened into a fine squint. "Welcome my visits."
"Please, Colonel. A girl must hold on to some mystery."
And tapping on the tip of his reddened nose with a gloved finger, she went inside. But her heart was pounding all the while.
"Was that Colonel Hamilton?"
Peggy's voice greeted her. She rushed into the hall and pulled Eliza into the heated parlor after Eliza had removed her frozen wet boots.
"Louisa says you've been gone for hours. Tell all."
Eliza opened her mouth but didn't know where to start. She shrugged.
"Colonel Hamilton and I paid a visit to Infirmary C."
"You—" Now it was Peggy's turn to be speechless.
"I do not know what to say to that."
"Neither do I," Eliza said. "But I think I like him,"
she said in a small voice. It took Peggy a moment to process this. Then she squealed.
"You like him?"
"I do. I like him,"
Eliza exclaimed, admitting what she had felt for a while now.
"I can't believe it! At last, a suitor the Schuyler parents will approve of. Washington's most trusted aide, and neither too British, nor too young, nor too rich. Mama will not like that, I fear."
"Pshaw," Peggy scoffed.
"Stephen's fortune will more than make up for any deficiencies in Colonel Hamilton's accounts. And Church is not doing so badly either," she added as Angelica joined them.
"Is there more news?"
asked Eliza, turning to her older sister, whose beau had left town for a few days.
"Yes, he arrives on the morrow. He writes that he comes with a question in his heart."
"A question? But he has already asked you to marry him, and you have already accepted. What other question could he have for you?"
asked Peggy.
"He has been pressing me to get Papa to bless our union. I have mentioned it to him several times, but Papa always shuts down the subject. He says that it's bad enough that John is British, but his past is simply too shady. He has heard rumors that John left gambling debts behind him in England, and he couldn't bear to see him do the same with my dowry."
"But Papa knows what you told me the other night, does he not? That John is, how did you phrase it, running guns for our troops, an activity that is both lucrative and honorable," said Eliza.
Angelica shrugged. "You know, Papa, once he's made up his mind about someone, it never changes."
"So then what do you think Mr. Church's question will be?"
Peggy persisted. Angelica looked at her sisters nervously.
"I think he is going to ask me to elope."
"What?"
Eliza gasped as Peggy literally clutched her pearls.
"You cannot be serious. Surely you did not lead him to think that you would accept."
"Oh, Angelica."
Eliza stopped herself when she saw her sister's face.
"You're not going to run off with him."
"I think..."
Angelica broke off and was silent for a long time.
I think I am.
Peggy grabbed her sister's hand.
But does this mean you love him?
More silence from Angelica, who smiled whimsically and stared off into space.
I think I see us as Mama and Papa are. Not enthralled with each other, but respectful and supportive. Two people joined together in a partnership to create something enduring. A family, a legacy.
But do you love him? Eliza pressed.
You are too young and too beautiful to give up on love yet. There are more young men out there.
Are there? Angelica said, getting up and heading to the door. Or are they all ending up in the infirmary or the kirkyard? She paused at the door.
Mama and Papa raised us to expect a certain lifestyle. You were always less enamored of material comforts than other girls, but Peggy and I, well, we like our things, don't we? And John will provide me with all the things I want, and adventures as well.
She smiled at her younger sister.
Dearest Eliza, you'll have to have the romance for us.
And she slipped into the hall, letting a shiver of cold air into the room.
22. Sweet Nothings.
South Street, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. Being that Alexander Hamilton was a man of many words, he decided to put them to use to win over his Eliza. He began with a series of letters to her sister Peggy, where he poured out his feelings, knowing the sentiments would be transferred to Eliza forthwith. Since confiding in him at the dinner party, he and Peggy had a sibling-like friendship, and it was to her that he entreated his courtship of Eliza. When he wrote, he appealed both to Eliza's vanity and her practicality. She is unquestionably lovely, yet she lacks the petty affectations of women who believe themselves very beautiful. He admired her love of nature and the outdoors. Eliza's face glows with the expectation of morning sunshine, and I happily imagine her as a rollicking, good-natured tomboy as a child. No woman, he wrote, could match her sister's unlimited passion for reading. He even begged Peggy to encourage her sister to continue studying French, so one day they might share secrets in their own private language. These, Alex wrote and reams of pages, were all things he would choose to champion in the perfect woman. Peggy wrote him back with a much simpler plan.
My dear Colonel Hamilton, if you want to win over my sister, why not simply tell her so yourself?
The cool blue evening under the pine trees smelled sweet, and the air called for a thick coat, even standing in front of a roaring bonfire. Alex had taken Peggy's hint and invited Eliza to step out with him along the Morristown Green, where a seasonal lighting of the bonfire on South Street was set to begin at dusk. Alex and Eliza squeezed toward the front of the crowd, where a tall boy with long fingers and thin beige bangs played his mandolin. People began to cough and clear their throats after two songs. In due course, somebody tossed a turpentine-soaked rag into the bonfire's brushwood and lit a match. There was a wind-sucking va-roomph, and the faces of 50-odd souls flashed orange in the firelight. The bracing, sweet smell of the burning pine wood surrounded them. When he sensed she was feeling cold, he wrapped an arm around her shoulder and rode his fingertips up and down her elbow to create warmth. He lowered his mouth to her ear and whispered, "You are so special to me, my dearest Betsy, and I want you to know it this very moment. Do you think you could ever be persuaded to feel the same toward this poor soldier?" He had taken to calling her Betsy when they were alone, a name only he called her and no one else.
"Perhaps one day," she said, "you have yet to take me on that long-promised sleigh ride, Colonel."
"Only say the word, my sweet nut-brown maid," he said, "and I shall make sure Hector will be at your door with bells on."
And Alex, please. Call me Alex.
Alexander, she said with a smile. You take too many liberties, just like our Congress against the British.
My darling, you are the declaration of my heart, he said, enjoying this game.
Alex, she said at last, it is nice to be with you here tonight. He thrilled to hear the sound of his given name on her lips. At the very least, my sister will finally stop pestering me about you, she said.
They may pester away, for it is to Peggy, I think, that we are here together.
They stood in front of the bonfire, enjoying its warmth and each other's. At the end of the next song, a fellow stepped into the slant of firelight in front of Alex. At first, he didn't recognize the tall, elegant figure wearing civilian clothes, backlit by the blaze. In the low light beyond the edge of the bonfire, it was unlikely that Major John Andre would have been recognized by anyone but Alex.
"Good evening, sir," said Alex. "And what brings you here?"
Alex took a step forward in the firelight. He noticed the Major's face was flushed, and beads of sweat tracked along the swale of his high cheekbones. He seemed to be in a hurry.
"Ah, Colonel Hamilton, and Miss Schuyler as well. What a pleasant surprise. But please, you mustn't get too close to me. I was merely passing through Morristown, only to have been waylaid by a nasty bout of cold, which I now fear is racing toward pneumonia. I'm out of my sick bed to get to the apothecary for a remedy. Yes, yes, that's it. And now I really must be on my way. Good evening to you both."
The Major tucked his chin under the scarf around his neck and cut through the crowd enjoying the bonfire. John Andre stepped out into the street and took a turn in the direction of Whitehead Street.
"Strange," Alex pondered out loud. "The apothecary is in the other direction. I've always admired the fellow for his fortitude of mind. But this time it is as if he's hiding something."
He looked down at Eliza, who was pensive.
"What is it, my darling?"
"He asked me to marry him once," she confessed.
Alex stiffened. "Your dance partner. You danced with him 5 times, I remember."
"I counted." She saw the look on his face. "I didn't say yes."
"But you were fond of him."
"A schoolgirl's crush, that is all." He breathed in sharply. A British officer, asking the hand of American aristocracy.
But of course Andre would feel confident enough to ask for Eliza's hand. He was wealthy and, enemy or no, had family and fortune that Alex lacked.
He was ashamed all of a sudden. Now it was Eliza's turn to ask him what was the matter.
"It is nothing," he said weakly.
"I didn't want him," she said.
"But why not?" he asked, unable to help himself. If Eliza would turn down someone as worthy as Andre, what hope did he, Alex, have of success in his suit?
Eliza contemplated her answer. Walking through the infirmary ward with Colonel Hamilton these past days had shown her a softer side of what an officer must be, the one who cares for his men above all else and is willing to see them honored for their service to the new country he believed in so fervently. Yes, she had seen Alex's temper flare over his disappointment with a lack of his own regiment to command. But she saw that as merely the fighting spirit of an ambitious and confident leader. Yet wasn't that what appealed most to her about him? A spirit and impetuousness that could match her own and challenge her to better herself in this new democracy? A man who could honor her own values? Yes, it was true. Once she had been quite enamored of the elegant Major John Andre. But here and now, for Eliza, all of Major Andre's former appeal seemed to vanish in the night air, snuffed out like the pine needles curling orange in the blazing bonfire before her. In its place, she would enjoy the light dancing in Alex's eyes,
and the fire ignited in her heart forever, and told him so.
"I didn't accept him," she said. "I fear I am too patriotic to marry against the cause."
He seemed satisfied with the answer.
"I didn't accept him,"
Eliza thought but didn't say,
"because he wasn't you."
23. Full hearts, empty pockets. Continental Army Headquarters and Cochrane Dinner Table, Part 2. Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. Walking on a cloud after another evening with Eliza, Alex had lost all track of time. He arrived back at headquarters well after the evening guard had been posted, a young corporal huddled in the small shelter in front of the Ford mansion. Swathed in a half-dozen blankets topped by an enormous bearskin, the sleepy fellow made some motion beneath the pile of rugs as Alex approached. It might have been a salute aimed at the familiar figure of Colonel Hamilton, but there were so many layers of fabric over the man's body that Alex wasn't sure.
"Password, Colonel."
Alex opened his mouth, only to draw a total blank. The password? He had forgotten the password, which was rather awkward since he was in charge of coming up with them.
Eliza, he said after a moment. Colonel?
For the past month, the passwords had all been names of birds.
Elizabeth,
Alex said. Beth, Betty, Betsy, Bits, Lisa, Liza, Eliza?
You tried that one already, the guard said. And I shall keep trying it.
Alex saluted the guard as he sauntered past him toward the mansion. For it is the only name on my mind.
Feel free to shoot me, Corporal, he added. I am so in love that bullets will only bounce off.
The lieutenant in command appeared suddenly and motioned to the young guard. He had heard the colonel's frank revelation of love and felt pity for him.
Lawrence is right. You are a gone man. It's Nightjar, Colonel Hamilton. The password is Nightjar,
said Lieutenant Larpent.
Nay, it's Elizabeth Schuyler,
Alex called back over his shoulder.
That is the key that opens all locks, or at least the one to my heart.
As he spoke, he grasped the door handle to the mansion and pulled hard, smacking his nose on its oak panels because it was locked. He tapped at his pockets, but he already knew they were empty. He had left his keys behind when he snuck off to see Eliza.
I've got it, sir,
said Larpent, amused, as he got up to unlock the door.
Yes, yes, thank you, Lieutenant, he said sheepishly.
Long day, don't you know? Running the army and, that sort of thing.
The next morning, he received a note from Gertrude Cochrane asking him if he would like to dine en famille with them that evening.
I know you graced us with your presence just a few days ago, but Angelica's beau, Mr. Church, is in Morristown, as is Peggy's Mr. Van Rensselaer, whom you met the other night. It seems a shame that Eliza should not have her own young man to dote on her, lest she feel left out. I am afraid we are only offering the usual venison stew, but the portions will be plentiful, and there is as much perry to quaff as you can hold.
Alex immediately dashed off a short note. It would be my pleasure to be a guest at your table, and spent the rest of the day contemplating the significance of Mrs. Cochrane's missive. Eliza's aunt had attempted to play matchmaker before and could simply be doing so again. But there was something leading in her use of the words, her own young man. Had Eliza spoken to her aunt? Had she told her that there was something between them? If so, this was the best news he had had all winter. Certainly their time together so far had been encouraging, but he didn't want to assume too much. But he didn't want to play it too cool, either, lest she think he was careless of her feelings. Fortunately, General Washington was away, and the workload was relatively light.
the usual appeals to wealthy American businessmen and plantation owners asking for money or munitions or wool or food, the various summaries of troop movements and intelligence, the flood of letters of condolence for soldiers who had succumbed to their wounds or illness. There were only three today. A blessing. By 5, he was out of the office and back to his quarters, where he bade the manservant he shared with 4 other officers to press and brush his uniform into crisp neatness and polish his boots. There wasn't time to heat a proper bath, so he stripped down to his tunic and hose and washed his armpits and nethers with frigid water from the basin, then splashed himself with rose water and dressed in his freshened uniform. He would have liked to have brought flowers, but it was the middle of the winter in northern New Jersey. Flowers were but a distant memory. But as he headed out, he spied a small bowl of oranges on a side table. They glowed like little suns in the dim room, and he couldn't imagine how they'd survived from whatever tropical clime they'd originated in. He shared this house with 7 other officers, and he knew the oranges were intended for all of them. But he knew that fresh fruit in February would be more welcome than 3 dozen red roses. He grabbed a sack and tipped the oranges into it, and quickly headed out into the evening. Lights were blazing in the main parlor of the Cochrans' appropriated house, and multiple shadows could be seen moving around beyond the heavy curtains, drawn against the cold. Alex rang the bell, and Ulysses let him in. He took Alex's coat and hat in the hall and showed him into the parlor. The room radiated with heat. The 3 Schuyler sisters were present, Angelica and Eliza seated on a sofa and Peggy on a chair nearby, while Stephen Van Rensselaer and a short, portly man in his early 30s occupied a pair of cane chairs on the other side of the room. Van Rensselaer was out of earshot, yet the drone of his voice could be discerned from the expression on his face. Church stared at him blankly, clutching a goblet as though it were the only thing that kept him from bolting from the room. Alex tried to catch Eliza's eye, but Aunt Gertrude rose from the same wing-backed chair Eliza had occupied days before and interposed herself between him and his object. "Colonel Hamilton, it is so good of you to grace us with your presence on such short notice, and so soon after your last visit." She glanced at the sack in his hand. "And you brought your laundry." Alex laughed at her joke. "Actually," he said, opening the top of the sack, "they're oranges," Aunt Gertrude almost shrieked. "Oh, what a blessed sight. We ate the last soft apples from the cellar just after Candlemas, and haven't seen a rind of fruit since. Oh, I feel healthier just looking at these. 8 of them. My stars! These must have cost as much as a good mule." She leaned in close, and as she did, Alex got a good whiff of perry on her breath. Aunt Gertrude, it seemed, was tipsy. "Dr. Cochran is away until Monday. I'll split his with you, and it'll be our little secret."
"It's a deal," Alex said. He handed the sack over and turned toward Eliza, only to have Mrs. Cochran grab him with her free hand and turn him toward Van Rensselaer and Church.
"We're too small a party to segregate into separate parlors," she said, as she led him to the pair of men. "And wood is so dear to heat a second room as well, so just pretend that you gentlemen are in your own chamber and we ladies are in ours. Mr. Van Rensselaer, I believe you know Colonel Hamilton? Colonel Hamilton, this is Mr. John Barker Church, an Englishman, I'm afraid," she added mischievously, "but one who aids our side at no inconsiderable risk to his own person. Dinner should be ready in a 30 minutes or so," she said, retreating to the far side of the parlor. Alex shook the men's hands and took a seat on his own cane chair. The chair had its back to the women, and he didn't want to appear rude by turning it, so he sat at somewhat of an angle, so he could at least glance at Eliza out of the corner of his eye. At least her sofa faced his side of the room,
and he could make occasional, if brief, eye contact.
"Colonel Hamilton," John Church said now, "you honor us with your presence. It is well that we should have